Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I would like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Michael Milstein. Thank you. You may begin.
Thanks, Brittany, and thank you all for joining us. I'm Michael Milstein from NOAA Fisheries West Coast Region. As many of you know, we've had a large number of gray whales stranding along the West Coast in recent months. We know many of the whales have been skinny and malnourished, and that suggests they may not have gotten enough to eat during their last feeding season in the Arctic. As of today, we've recorded 70 stranded dead gray whales in the United States, 37 in California, 3 in Oregon, 25 in Washington, and 5 in Alaska. In Canada, our counterparts at DFO report 5 confirmed strandings in British Columbia. Taken together, that's the most in 1 year since 2000. The eastern North Pacific population of gray whales that migrates along the Pacific coast numbers about 27,000 as of the last population assessment in 2016. NOAA Fisheries has now declared this increase in strandings an unusual mortality event, which is a designation under the Marine Mammal Protection Act that brings additional scientific expertise and resources to bear and to help respond to the strandings and understand what's behind them. So we're going to explain what that means, and then we'll take questions. So with us today, we have Deborah Fauquier, a veterinary medical officer with our Office of Protected Resources. David Weller, who's a research biologist at our Southwest Fisheries Science Center in La Jolla. Paul Cottrell, marine mammal coordinator with Fisheries and Oceans Canada. Justin Visbecki, stranding coordinator for California. Kristen Wilkinson, who's the coordinator for Oregon and Washington, and Kate Savage, the stranding health specialist in Alaska. We also have two members of the UME working group that recommended recognizing the strandings as a UME. That's John Kalabakidis, a research biologist with Cascadia Research Collective in Olympia, and Sue Moore, who's a biological oceanographer with the University of Washington. Now we'll let Deb explain what a UME is and what it means, and then Dave will describe a little bit about what we know about the gray whale population now and what the strandings may mean. Then we'll take questions. So, Deb, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Michael. Just to remind folks, my name is Deb Fauquier. I am a veterinary medical officer within NOAA's Fisheries Office of Protected Resources here at our headquarters in Silver Spring, Maryland. And as Michael mentioned, today we are declaring an unusual mortality event, or UME, for the eastern North Pacific population of gray whales. The Marine Mammal Protection Act defines an unusual mortality event as a stranding event that is unexpected, involves a significant die-off, and demands an immediate response. In the case of the gray whales, the significant die-off of these animals we've seen this year demands an investigation to determine what might be causing the die-off, such as environmental conditions, disease, or human activities. Ultimately, a UME investigation can help provide those answers to scientists, fisheries managers, and policymakers so we can make informed decisions to protect this important marine species. Prior to the declaration of a UME, a panel of marine mammal experts, the UME Working Group, uses 7 criteria to assess potential UMEs and then recommends to NOAA Fisheries whether a UME should be declared. In this case, the UME Working Group determined that the gray whale strandings this year meet 2 of the 7 criteria. They are a marked increase in the magnitude or a marked change in the nature of morbidity, mortality, or strandings when compared with prior records, and similar unusual pathologic findings in stranded animals, including behavior patterns, clinical signs, or general physical conditions such as blubber thickness. What will happen now is a gray whale UME investigative team will be established and an on-site coordinator will be designated to move forward with the investigation and response. Together, they'll work to develop a response plan that includes assessing responder needs, forming a team to develop research plans with experts from the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and across the globe if needed. The public can play an important role in helping NOAA and our partners respond to the stranded gray whales. First, we urge the public to report any sick, stranded, or dead gray whales. It's important that the public not approach any marine mammals in distress, since you can hurt yourself as well as the animal, and it is also illegal. Hotline numbers are posted on our website, and you can reach the network there through those numbers. And also, the daily response to the gray whales is currently being conducted by our Marine Mammal Stranding Network partners, which are run by academic organizations, non-governmental or nonprofit organizations, or the states. Many of these stranding network partners rely on in-kind support or donations. So the public can reach out and provide that assistance, or they can visit pay.gov and search for and donate to the UME Contingency Fund. And links to our stranding network partners and the UME Contingency Fund can be found on our website. With that said, I'm going to send it back to Michael.
Okay, thanks, Deb. Now I'll turn it over to Dave Weller. He's a research wildlife biologist from our Southwest Fishery Science Center in La Jolla, California, and focuses particularly on gray whales. Dave?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Dave Weller here, calling from La Jolla, California. And as Michael said, I'm at the NOAA Southwest Fisheries Science Center. Our center is the agency lead for gray whale research, and I'm the point of contact for this research and work. I want to just briefly tell you about two of our main research programs that really help to inform us about the consequences of a UME, like the one we're experiencing currently. The first of those programs is what we call population abundance surveys, and that's to estimate the total number of gray whales in the eastern North Pacific. We conduct two surveys back-to-back in a given five-year period. The last one was done in 2014-2015, followed by the back-to-back element in 2015-2016. And the abundance estimate for 2016 is the most current we have, and that's about 27,000 whales in the eastern North Pacific. The 2016 estimate of 27,000 is very much on par with the 1987-1988 estimate, which was 26,900. Each of those numbers represent the highest level of abundance that we've recorded for the population in the time series, and the time series of data go back to 1967. Our next set of abundance surveys will be beginning in December of this year, 2019, and go through the migration. This is the southward migration in 2020. We'll follow that up again the following year, beginning in December 2020 and going through February of 2021. The other major research program that we conduct here at Southwest is what we call calf production surveys. These surveys are done annually. They began in 1994 when the ENP population was delisted, and they go all the way through 2019. So every year since 1994, we've been conducting these surveys on the number of calves that are born into the eastern North Pacific population of gray whales. What we've learned from those surveys is that calf production is is highly variable on any given year. But interestingly, it's been consistently high with more than 1,000 calves born annually in the period between 2012 and 2017. In 2016, the calf estimate was about 1,400 calves, and that represents about 5% of the corresponding abundance estimate of 27,000 from the same year. Data for 2019 are being quality inspected at this point, but our preliminary assessment indicates that calf production this year is going to be relatively low, although not outside the bounds of what we've observed in previous years. And that is, for example, in 2000 and 2001, and also again in 2009 and 2010. Since 2015, we've added to this survey drone-based photogrammetry work to assess female calf body condition. And for the period of 1994 through 2016, my colleague Wayne Perryman has found a very close correlation between the timing of sea ice retreat in the Arctic and calf production. And that is when sea ice is late to retreat and pregnant females don't have early access to the Arctic feeding area, there seems to be a slightly lagged decrease in calf production in the following year or the year after that. In terms of the climate, Arctic changes, and the food base, Sue Moore is on the line with us, and she'll be able to fill you in better on some of those aspects. But I did want to just make a couple of quick notes for you. That many of the stranded whales in 2019 have been in poor body condition or malnourished, and that's possibly related to poor feeding or feeding conditions during the 2018 summer-fall season. Poor feeding in 2018 would result in subpar energetic reserves for some whales, which would become most apparent at this very time of the year, and that is because those whales, when they leave the Arctic feeding grounds in December, for example, or in late November, they migrate to Mexico, and they're on their way back from Mexico back to the Arctic feeding grounds after not having fed for several months. So right now, off the west coast of the U.S. and Canada is really the primary time when they're under peak nutritional stress. So we would expect animals to be on the thin side, but not necessarily emaciated. And then finally, in closing, I just wanted to mention carrying capacity. I know that concept is being bounced around as a possible explanation for not only the current UME, but also the previous one in 99-2000. And carrying capacity is the ability of the environment to maintain a population of a given size. And I think there is some theorizing going on that the population at 27,000 has exceeded the ability of the environment to provide enough food for them. But we also, I think, also should be aware and keep in mind that carrying capacity is not a hard ceiling, but that it's a shifting threshold, and that in some years or a period of years, the environment is capable of supporting more whales than in other years. And thanks very much for your time, and I'll stand by for any questions.
All right. Thanks very much, Dave. And I'll point out on our we have a Flickr album set up that's linked on the media advisory, and there's a graph there showing the calf count and the population size over the last couple decades. There also is an example of one of those drone photos of a mother and calf that that Dave mentioned. Okay, well, we have a number of experts on the line, so if you would like to ask a question specific to one of the experts we have, please mention that. Otherwise, we'll direct it to the one with the most appropriate experience. Operator, we can start taking questions.
And if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. If you need to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing star, then two. Our first question comes from Elizabeth Ways from USA Today. Your line is now open.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call. I had a question, could be for the entire group. So you were saying that if the sea ice is late to retreat, then the pregnant females might not have as much access to the Arctic feeding areas as they would have, and so they'd be underweight and might not have as much calf production. It's my understanding that last year was a abnormally warm period in the Arctic area around Alaska where they feed, and so I would presume that would mean that the ice retreated earlier. So what's the thinking of what conceivably could have caused this?
Yeah, hi, this is Dave, and it's a good question. I forgot to mention, and you're exactly right, is that relationship between sea ice retreat early in the season, that has broken down in the past few years. So I was negligent in mentioning that relationship was true for 1994 through 2016, but in the past few years, we're not able to find that same strong correlation. So something has changed that we're trying to track and trying to better understand, and Sue Moore might have more on that, Matt, for you.
Sue, do you want to jump in?
Well, sure. Actually, yes, the caller is right. In 2018, we had a very anomalous warm season in ice in the Northern Bering Sea, which is where gray whales go to feed. They also feed in the Chukchi Sea, so up in the Arctic. And so, as Dave just said, the modeling approach that seemed to be working for a number of years has broken down, and we are also seeing just very, very warm sea conditions as well in that area. So the Arctic is changing very, very quickly, and whales are going to have to adjust to that. But gray whales are good at eating a variety of things. So it becomes a complex question very quickly.
Can I ask a follow-on question? Is there any sense that warmer water temperatures might be affecting their primary, and I cannot remember how to pronounce, the little things that they like to eat, but you know what they are.
Yeah. So gray whales can eat a lot of different things, but they're most famous for, I guess, eating amphipods, which are found in the sediments. And the complex relationship there is whether or not the sea ice provides basically fertilizer to those amphipod beds. The sea ice has been changing very quickly over the last decade or so. We actually think the system itself is more productive, but not necessarily with the type of algae that feeds those amphipod beds. So the whales may have to shift to other prey, such as krill or other things that they eat. We are sampling those amphipod beds consistently year after year now for the past 10 years, and we are seeing a shift northward in those.
John, do you have anything further to add on this?
No, that sounds good.
Okay. All right, thanks. Let's go on to the next question.
And our next question comes from Shannon Ballard from KTVA 11 News, Anchorage. Your line is now open.
Hi, I am wondering if there is any projection for this year's feeding grounds and if it's possible that we'll see similar strandings next year to the same extent.
Well, this is Sue Moore again. The folks that keep the best track that we have of how the animals are feeding offshore Alaska are doing so under a program called Aerial Survey of Arctic Marine Mammals. It's a survey program that's been ongoing for over 30 years. And actually, they have seen a lot of feeding gray whales in the Chukchi Sea. I believe 2018 was one of the peak years for number of feeding gray whales up there, and also that the gray whales were still feeding in high numbers through September. Generally, they're there July, August, and begin moving south again in September. But in 2018, there were quite a few sightings there. Those data are available online if you go to the Alaska Fishery Science Center webpage and type in ASAMM, A-S-A-M-M. There's a lot of information there on how they conduct the surveys and what they've seen in these past years.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to the next question.
And our next question comes from Paul Rogers from San Jose Mercury News. Your line is now open.
Oh, hi. This is for any of the researchers who want to take it. I actually have two questions. The first is, as you pointed out, their population seems to be near an all-time high in terms of what we've been able to record. And 70 numbers is obvious. 70 is a very small percent of that total. So for the general public out there, first of all, I'm interested how concerned you folks are about this die-off. And then second, do you have any estimate in terms of if 70 were stranded, how many total might have died from similar causes and just sunk or never turned up along the shoreline?
Dave, do you want to jump in here? Dave or John?
This is John. I could just comment on a couple of aspects of this, and maybe Dave can add to that. And I think it is a good point. We do know that most whales, and especially emaciated whales, will tend to sink when dead. So the numbers that actually wash up do represent a fraction of the true numbers. And there have been some attempts to estimate that, suggesting it might be as few as 10% represent the portion that wash up. But it's a number that has been, difficult to quantify. But certainly it's the vast majority go unreported, either sinking or in the cases of areas like Alaska, you have remote areas, even if they wash up, that would make them hard to find and quantify. So that's one factor that's at work. The other one that I would point out is especially for, I would say, Washington and north, we are still pretty early in the season. So as we talk about these total numbers, at Washington, we're still sort of near the peak of the event. In the 1999-2000 event, almost half the mortalities were after this date in the year. So the totals that are being reported here today are partial totals in that sense as well, in that the event is still very much ongoing.
Did we get both your questions, Paul?
Well, I'm curious about the first one, how concerned the researchers are about this die-off, given that it's a small percentage of the total population.
Yeah, this is Dave Weller, and I can try and help there. So we are concerned. We've been, you know, following these whales closely since 1994 and even before then, trying to understand how a depleted population at one point is able to continue to grow and thrive and answer broad questions such as carrying capacity and other things like that. So I think what we're most interested in right now is examination of these individuals that are coming to shore to see how much we can learn from them by way of necropsies and other bioassays to learn something about their health and their condition. From a population level, we know from past data that this population is capable of rebounding from a loss of on the order of at least 6,000, perhaps. That's what was estimated to have been lost in the previous UME. So we know that it can recover. That's given that all other parameters remain the same. The environment is essentially the same, and there's enough food and other things of that nature. So I would say that probably the number one priority is learning as much as we can from the stranded animals and trying to understand what's happening with them. And then our monitoring will continue. We'll do another abundance estimate to see whether there's any population signal, population level signal that we can detect in numbers. And then we'll also be following calf production. So we've got our finger on the pulse. And I would say that we want to continue to monitor it closely.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Brittany, let's go to the next question.
And our next question comes from Grant Robinson from KTUU. Your line is now open.
Thank you. One of the previous folks mentioned that for Washington and Northern and Alaska, it's still early in the migration. So for how much longer can folks be expecting to see these gray whales washing up in their areas throughout Alaska?
John, do you want to take that?
I'll just comment for Washington, and then maybe relative to BC and Alaska, there can be a comment there. Consistent with both past years and even the 1999-2000 event, our peak months that we see mortality extend from March through June, and in those big years that extended into July for Washington State. And bearing in mind, sometimes those documented strandings are probably occurring, weeks after the animal died, an animal that's floating around or sunk in shallow water and took a while to bloat and then come to shore. So especially the later strandings tended to often be even more decomposed animals. So at least for Washington, I'd say we're somewhere near or hopefully just past the halfway point, and we might see strandings through July. And I don't know if Paul or others have a perspective for what that might look like north of Washington.
Paul, would you like to jump in?
Yeah. Thanks, John. Yeah, it's consistent with Washington State with British Columbia. We consider we're usually with gray whale deaths, this is about the halfway point. So the expectation is that we're halfway into this and that we'll be looking out for what's coming forward here.
Kate Savage, would you like to address that for Alaska?
Sure. We are on the early side of things. Typically our strandings parallel the migration up the coast and into the Bering Sea and the Arctic. Typically, Gulf of Alaska, June, we see most of the strandings, and then the Bering Sea, it's July and August, and then the Arctic, it stretches into September. So July, August, and September are the peak months. So we're just starting here, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. Brittany, let's go to the next question.
And our next question comes from Gene Johnson from Visa Press. Your line is now open.
Hi. I was wondering if you folks could address the earlier UME and the response to that. Is there an understanding of why no specific cause was able to be identified? And also, were there any actions taken to help respond to it, or was it more of just a study and review of the cause and what was happening?
Deb, would you like to address that?
Sorry, Michael. We were just discussing. Actually, I was going to let Sue start on that. Because okay. She was involved in several of the publications on the cause, if she doesn't mind.
No, that's fine. So, Sue Moore here again. Yeah, we were really very, very surprised back in 99 and 2000 when that event started to unfold. But the response I felt was as good as it could be. The reason for, the inability, I guess, to figure out what was causing this was in large part because it is very difficult sometimes to get to these whales in a timely fashion. So you cannot always get the kinds of samples that you would need for diagnostic reasons. And then, again, this particular species is very flexible in the diet that they can eat. There are a lot of complicating factors in terms of how the ecosystem is changing and was changing then. It was just after a very big El Nino event at that time. And so the implication was those warming waters basically resulted in less food for the animals. But there were animals that stranded and were not in emaciated condition, were in good body condition overall, or at least fair body condition, but, of course, were just as dead as the emaciated ones. So as Deb mentioned at the outset, really we're looking at something in the environment or perhaps disease, and disease would be a difficult thing to really detect because of the condition of the whales that they present themselves in. And then there's also human-caused mortality of a ship strike or even contaminants in the water. All of these things may be playing a role, and we were unable to determine what mix of those things or if there was one predominant in that earlier event.
Okay. And can you say of the stranded whales that we have this year so far, I mean, how many have provided viable samples or samples that are useful from a diagnostic standpoint?
One of our stranding coordinators want to address that?
Or Michael, this is Deb. I can take that.
Okay, go ahead.
So we're still in the beginning stages of the UME investigation and compiling that data, but I would say that we've been much more successful at being able to necropsy animals and collect samples for this event versus the 99-2000. And I think that's a combination of the whales have been closer to shore in areas where we can actually access them, and also we have an improved stranding network. In the last 20 years, we've definitely improved the coverage, at least for the California, Oregon, Washington areas. Alaska is always difficult because of the remote logistics of responding in Alaska. But I would just say off the top of my head, and the coordinators could correct me, but I'm going to say we've necropsied at least 20 of the whales, if not more. And Sue can correct me, I believe in the 99-2000 event, it was less than 10 that maybe got necropsied.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and I'll point out the anyone who wants interested in that previous UME in 99-2000, the report from that is linked on the media advisory as well. Okay, Brittany, can we go to the next question?
And our next question comes from Matt Hurz from Alaska Energy Desk. Your line is now open.
Hi. I guess I'm wondering, it seems like assigning a cause is a really complicated process and one that's probably really far off. And I'm wondering sort of for the nearer term, say for the next 6 to 12 months, I'd love to hear maybe from like each of the experts on the line or a handful of the experts on the line, like what is one question you have about this event that you're hoping to actually be able to answer in the next, say, 6 months to a year?
Dave or John, do you want to take that one?
And this is John. I think Dave did a good job earlier in describing that in the midst of this right now, our focus has been getting an accurate documentation of the number, the species, the body condition, collecting the even information like the age class of the animals that are involved. We also try to, as best we can, identify the individuals to see if they're individuals that we've seen or tracked while they were alive based on their natural markings to get some insight into what they had been doing previously and which of the feeding areas maybe they had come from. And then collecting this variety of tissues that can be subjected to further tests. And I'll point out one very simple thing. Even judging emaciation in some of these animals can be a little bit challenging because while a thin emaciated animal sounds sort of obvious, these animals often bloat when as they start to decompose, so an animal can look very puffed out, and even their blubber layer can be reasonably thick in an adult animal, but it'll turn out that blubber layer has almost no oil or lipid left in it, so it actually is an animal that is emaciated and used up its stores. So those are the sorts of immediate questions that I feel like we're focused on in the short run.
Okay, let's go to the next question.
Can I follow up on that quickly?
Okay.
I guess I'm just wondering, I mean, is it fair to say, I think there's a lot of sort of questioning that I've heard from people in my audience, like, about assigning a cause here. I mean, it seems like the overarching message is that, like, we still don't really even understand the scope and extent of the problem here, and just understanding that is going to take a long time, and that the sort of ultimate cause, it's people aren't going to get, people shouldn't be expecting that for quite a long time.
Sorry, Michael. This is Deb. Yes, that is correct. So generally with our unusual mortality event investigations, especially one like this where we currently do not know a cause at the declaration, it can take months to years to finally do the research to actually identify the cause. And there may be multiple causes. There may be contributory causes. So, yes, the investigation of the actual cause may take several months to over a year, if not longer.
All right. We have a number of other questions, so let's go to the next question.
Our next is from Reuters. Urith Rosen, your line is open.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to get back to the question of what's happening in the Arctic and subarctic waters this year. There's been some, there was no cold pool in the Bering Sea last year, and there's been some strandings of seal and walrus, but I know walrus is not your area. But are you going to look at the other species and maybe the other marine mammal species to see what's going on, you know, if these events are related?
Michael, the step, do you want me to take that?
Yes.
Okay. So as part of the UME investigation with our investigative team, we bring in experts about gray whales, but we also bring in experts about the larger environment, and that includes other animals and other species. So we will have oceanographers to help us with understanding the environment of the ocean. We'll have fish biologists to help us understand about what's going on with the food web. We'll bring in experts from U.S. Fish and Wildlife because we do have some die-offs of birds along the California coast, so we just want to make sure that what's affecting the birds is different or the same as what's affecting the whales. And we would work with our partners at also U.S. Fish and Wildlife for walrus for if there are, you know, mortalities of walrus up in Alaska.
And who was that speaking?
Sorry, this is Deb Fauquier.
All right. Let's go to the next question.
Our next question from Layla Miller, LA Times. Your line is open.
Can you, I guess, maybe unpack a little bit more. I know you just talked about all the experts that are going to come together, but can you unpack a little bit more what the research will look like? How exactly, so when you look at the warming waters of the Gulf of Alaska, what questions are you looking at? So I'm just looking for a better sense of the actual investigation and the research.
Deb, do you want to take that one?
So I'm gonna lean on Sue here. I will start it, and maybe Sue can answer it for me. So the UMU was just declared, so we haven't established our team, and we haven't developed all our research questions. But one of them is to look at the interlinkings between the actual ocean environment, what are the food doing, and then what are we finding in the whales. And so we will be having a subgroup of experts that will look at that question. But Sue, if you want to maybe expand that in better language for me, that would be wonderful.
Well, I have not actually been on an investigative team, but my sense is that we will be calling on resources of people that are sampling the ecosystem in the Northern Bering and Chukchi Sea on other science programs. So the Alaska Fisheries Center is conducting a fisheries research cruise in the Bering Sea this year. Further north, the North Pacific Research Board has two teams that have been actively looking at the ecosystem of the Northern Bering and Chukchi Sea. So there are quite a few experts that are currently working on how is that ecosystem changing. Who will be drawn upon for this particular investigation? I'm not quite sure who that will be yet, but we certainly have people with the appropriate background, I think, both in the agency and academia.
And this is Deb. I just wanted to add, since these animals are migratory, we will be following them as they come back down. Just like Dave said, there will be the surveys for that, but also if we have stranded whales that happen as they come down to Mexico in the fall, winter, we will be following them. And we will also be working with our Mexican colleagues to make sure we're sampling and getting information from those whales as well in the winter.
Okay, thanks. And what's your name?
This is Deb Fokier again.
Okay.
All right. Operator, let's go to the next question.
Paul Facey, CBS News. Your line is open.
Hi there. I'm sorry. I joined late. I just want to confirm that the total number of dead gray whales that washed ashore, it's still at 70?
That's correct, 70 in the United States.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Our next is Todd Harmer of BTV. Your line's open.
Todd, are you there?
Could you check your mute button, Todd?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Sorry about that. Earlier, someone had mentioned that the gray whales are flexible eaters, which I thought was possibly a good thing, but they are coming up malnourished and whatnot. So are they not adapting, or is it that all the food that they would seek is just not available?
This is Sue again. So up in the Arctic and in the Northern Bering, gray whales feed in a variety of locations, and we can only sample offshore Alaska at the moment anyway. Gray whales are all along the Siberian coast, the few times that people have been over there looking. So, again, they're very flexible. They range widely in terms of where they're feeding, so they might not be finding the type of food or the lipid-rich food that they need. But again, it very quickly is just a guess, you know, because, again, they feed all along their route and in broad areas in the northern waters.
Thanks. And just one other question. What's in a typical year, if there is such a thing, how many whales would die off?
Deb, do you have a sense of that?
I do. I just have to find the number because we do have the average.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the average for the United States since 1990 has been about 35 for the whole year.
Yes, and then our average right now for the 5 months of the year, for January and May, so the same period where we've had these 70 whales in the U.S., is 14.8 whales.
All right, let's go to the next question.
Thank you. Sterling Iard, CBC Radio, your line is open. Could you please check your mute button?
Oh, sorry, got me there? Hello.
Got you. Yep, go ahead.
Great. This is Sterling Aford at CBC. Maybe a question for Paul Cottrell or anyone. There is a resident population that spends a significant amount of the summer around Vancouver Island. Just wondering if there's any further consideration of watching that group for signs of malnutrition or problems.
Yeah, Paul here. Yeah, there is a certain segment of the population that spends the feeding summer off the west coast of Vancouver Island and other areas of British Columbia. So it's kind of a proportion of the population, and there is considerable research going on every year on those animals in terms of the numbers and photo identification, and genetic samples are taken from those animals as well. So that'll be ongoing as well, and probably even increased in terms of the importance of that research that's ongoing.
Sure. And do you expect to see more interaction with predators with gray whales? We saw the transient, the big Dorca, take that gray whale near Whidbey Island. I'm just wondering if there's any expectation that there could be more axe predation actually seen.
And this is John Kalamakidis. I could address that. And as best as we can tell from the photographs that were available, that particular predation event was actually scavenging. That the carcass looked had slough skin, looked like it was an animal that had already been dead, potentially of the causes related to this mortality event, or we couldn't rule out killed by killer whales earlier, but we're not sure it was predation. But I think you raised an important point in that we are seeing lots of live gray whales in unusual areas, some of them clearly emaciated, trying to feed, and that has brought animals sometimes into areas where they're going to be in greater contact with other threats, things like ship strikes. Along the west coast, we've seen more gray whales come into a number of protected bays and harbors, from San Francisco Bay to Los Angeles Long Beach Harbor, and also up in our area in Puget Sound. And all of that brings the animals into greater contact with shipping traffic, so vulnerability to ship strikes, and as well as fishing activities. And so potentially seeing more animals that have some of these other causes of death is possible because they're more exposed to them by virtue of this behavior. And then to just follow up on one other point, you are mentioning that more resident group of gray whales in this region, and sometimes that's been referred to as the Pacific Coast Feeding Group. It ranges from Northern California up through British Columbia, numbers about 250 animals. So it only represents less than 1% of the gray whale population. And at this point, we do participate in the monitoring of those animals. The main period we study those animals is from June through the fall, so it's still a little early for us to assess anything unusual with that group of animals. Though I will point out the last 2 years have been somewhat unusual for that Pacific Coast feeding group in that they've been less common in some of their areas they've typically fed, and we found them feeding in more atypical areas as well, and whether that will continue this year or not, we won't be able to determine for a few months.
All right, thanks. Let's go to the next question.
Peggy Parker of Seafood News. Your line is open, ma'am.
Thank you so much. This probably goes to Sue again, but thanks to all of you. Sue and Deb have been taking a lot of these questions. First off, the declaration and the additional research that will be done and investigations, resources to this problem, will it mean that veterinarians who can get to the carcasses by helicopter can stay there? I've It's my understanding that some have been restricted in time, only having, you know, an hour or so to conduct the tissue samples. So will that be will that change with this additional? And then I have one other question, which I can ask now if that's helpful.
I was going to let Kate answer the first part of that question because it really impacts, I would say, or Paul, British Columbia and Alaska.
Kate?
Yeah, hi. So I think the caller is talking about the carcass that washed up on the barrier islands of the Copper River Delta, which is like pretty shifting sand and not easy access. And so the Coast Guard was gracious and kind enough to take us out there to do a partial necropsy. We had like 3 hours, and we'll be going back out there. And I think that's going to be certainly the exception to the rule. We should be able to spend, you know, as much time as we want with most carcasses.
That's great. Thank you. The other question is there any reaching out to Russian marine mammal experts to, maybe there's an institutional sharing of data already on the population that feeds, I'm sorry, there is a separate population in the western northern Pacific. So do we know anything about strandings of those animals, and are they intermingled in the Chukchi feeding area with the eastern Pacific population?
I can help with that. This is Dave Weller. So the western North Pacific population is what you're referring to. And our best understanding of that group of whales, which numbers around 200, is that they remain within the Okhotsk Sea from the Kamchatka Peninsula over to Sakhalin Island during the summer to feed. And some of them migrate south to the coast of Asia, and some of them come over to the west coast of the U.S. As far as we know, they do not intermingle with the eastern North Pacific population in the Chukchi, although they do intermingle with them during migration and also along the west coast and also in the lagoons of Baja. We've got a team of Russian scientists that work annually off of Sakhalin Island and also to some degree Kamchatka in the Okhotsk Sea, monitoring the population status through photo ID and biopsy sampling and other techniques. And if there are any strandings, we'll be aware of them because we do have close contacts with them. We're also in contact with the Chukotka native hunt that takes place off of Chukotka further to the north. And if anything appears there, we'll also be made aware of it. So we do have the contacts and kind of the coverage in order to understand whether this is also translating to the western North Pacific.
Thank you so much. You reminded me of one other quick question, if I may. This is Peggy at Seafood News again. I think Sue mentioned that the feeding in the Beaufort, perhaps, was late last year. And it extended beyond the normal time. Is there any indication, is there any connection between that later feeding through September in the lack of sea ice forming and, more importantly, not enough food for them to get so that it just took longer for them to replenish their supplies?
Well, this is Sue, and again, it really wasn't an extension of time. There were just more animals seen in the Chukchi Sea, not the Beaufort, the Chukchi Sea in September 2018. And again, this is from aerial survey data, so you have comparable sampling across a number of years. The animals were feeding a little bit further offshore that year as well in a place called Hannah Shoal, but we know that that is a productive zone because walruses and other animals are often seen feeding there as well. So again, we're basing our understanding of feeding in the Arctic really on this aerial survey that has been going on for a long time, and it really does not sample some of the other areas that have been prime feeding areas in the past. It doesn't. The surveys cannot extend far enough south for that. So I wish we had better coverage and a better understanding, a fuller understanding of how the physical changes that are very apparent to us in the Arctic, how that is transitioning through the food web. But right now we're just piecing it together as we can. Again, there are a number of studies ongoing at the lower trophic levels, and hopefully we can bring some of that understanding to bear as we investigate this event.
Okay, I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Operator, can we go to the next question?
Of course, and thank you. Tegan Hanlon, Anchorage Daily News, your line is open.
Hi, thanks for your time. I had two quick questions for you, one specific to Alaska. I know there was mention that it's sort of early in this event here in Alaska, and there's a tremendous amount of remote coastline here. I'm wondering, now that UME has been declared, will anything different happen in Alaska in terms of resources deployed or activated to look for stranded whales or respond to stranded whales? And then secondarily, more broadly, I just wanted to get some clarity on the theory about carrying capacity. How much do researchers believe this is a cause of the strandings, if it is a cause at all?
Kate, do you want to take the first part of that?
Yeah, I can take the first part specific to Alaska, and then maybe Deb can discuss the resources available through the UME process. But once it became apparent that we were having an increase in gray whale mortalities, we sort of stepped up our action with the communities, and we sent out a flyer to communities along the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska, and we had radio public service announcements, and so we're trying to really track, as much as we can, the isolated coastline. And we are also have surveys planned along the coast of Kodiak and then up in the Bering Strait and then along Prince William Sound.
Okay. Can you repeat your second question real quickly?
Yeah, thank you. I just want to get some clarity about the carrying capacity, how much at this point scientists, researchers believe that is a cause in the strandings, if it is a cause at all.
Dave or John?
I thought Dave made a good point earlier that, carrying capacity varies by year, and I think it certainly plays a role, and that, I think part of how I would view it, too, that as animals are closer to limits of the food supply, that's when you would start to see a portion of the population that maybe isn't as fit or in as good shape become more vulnerable, and maybe that's the one point I would make. So that I don't view carrying capacity as necessarily, an explanation in and of itself, but it's probably a contributing factor with these other things affecting the dynamics and abundance of prey.
Okay, thanks. All right, let's take one last question.
Our last is from Kim Hickok, Live Science. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for fitting me in. I just wanted to know real quick, are there any trends noticeable yet with regards to the sex, age, or size of the animals that are stranding, and was there a trend with the last UME?
Does one of our stranding coordinators want to take the first part of that?
So this is Justin Visbicki from California, and I don't think there's been some juveniles, but there have been adults as well. There have been males and females, so it's kind of all across the board at this point.
Hi, this is Kate from Alaska. We still only have 5 animals, and we've had, 1 calf, maybe 2 calves. We're still trying to figure out the other one. One that's unknown, we're going to have to access the carcass a little bit more to get more information, and then 1 adult and 1 young adult. And we've had 2 males, 1 female, and 2 unknowns at this point.
Okay.
All here in British Columbia, we've only had 5 as well, but we've tended to have younger animals. We've had only 1 adult female. The rest have been juveniles or calves, so tending to for younger animals for us.
And very quickly, John, I'll talk just Washington State is about a third adults and two-thirds juveniles.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. I'm sorry we didn't get to all the questions, but I want to take a moment to thank all the speakers. You've been very patient and gracious, and thank you all for calling in and your good questions today. I just point out there are a number of resources linked on the media advisory, including a website set up by our headquarters Office of Protected Resources, and that's where they'll be updating the numbers on a regular basis and providing updates on the progress of the investigation. And again, there are some visuals on that in that Flickr album as well you might find interesting. Okay, well, with that, I'm going to wrap it up, and I appreciate all of you calling in. And if you have follow-up questions, there's a several of the media contacts are listed on the advisory, and we'll do what we can to help you get any further questions answered. With that, I think we can end the call. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
As conference is now concluded, again, thank you for your participation. You may please go ahead and disconnect. Enjoy the rest of your day.